Hello everyone, I'm Barbara Eadie from BarbaraEadie.com, and today I'm speaking with Daniel Epstein. Daniel is the founder of the Unreasonable Institute, an organization that supports social entrepreneurs from around the globe. Daniel believes entrepreneurship is the answer to nearly all the issues we face today and has dedicated his life to supporting businesses that are truly changing the world. By the time he'd received his BA in philosophy, Daniel had started three ventures in Boulder, Colorado. He co-founded two companies, including Tuition Specialists, which focused on making education more affordable, and another company, Unreasonable Adventures, which was dedicated to conservation and development through ecotourism. Then, in the summer of 2008, Daniel co-founded and directed a five-week institute that brought 17 young aspiring social entrepreneurs from 14 different countries, together in Boulder to understand and address key global issues. That program was the forerunner to the Unreasonable Institute. So welcome, Daniel, and thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Great. Okay, this is going to be fun. I would like to start with a quote that I read about you that says, "Only action validates theoretical knowledge. Life is too short not to be unreasonable." Can you tell me a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah. For me, I think for all of us at Unreasonable, we have a heavy bias towards action. I can't understand the notion of not stumbling your way through a problem, right? I think that at the end of the day, if we're really trying to solve these tough challenges, the solutions are never obvious. And you're never going to be able to talk your way into the solution. At the end of the day, the only go-to-market strategy for solving a problem is to go to market. And, you know, empathy is the key. And the way you build empathy is by getting into market and prototyping. So for us, we think that if you're going to have a chance in hell at putting a dent on any of these really tough challenges, you have to have this bias towards action, lean into prototyping, go to market, listen to the market, adapt, change, prototype, adapt, change, prototype, and eventually you'll land on an insight that comes through experience, not through discussion.
Right. So action, and again, the more unreasonable, the better, or even the unreasonable is the way to, as you said, test out these prototypes and know what you need to adapt before you know what you need to change.
Yeah, but okay. part of being unreasonable is not accepting the status quo for what it is, and being willing to experiment, towards hoping to put a dent on these massive challenges. But you have to be willing to fail. Google has a philosophy. They say they'd rather achieve 60% of the impossible than 100% of the possible. We've taken that a step further. We say, heck, at Unreasonable, we'd rather achieve 20% of the impossible if the goal is worthy enough. I don't mind failing 80% of the time because the 20% success is worth it if we're dealing with issues such as, you know, seemingly intractable amounts of poverty or shelter for a billion people or access to clean drinking water. I mean, we have to have the, I think, tenacity to try, but the humility to admit that we don't know, and so we're going to stumble through it.
Right. And those are huge issues to be tackling. So I've heard the Unreasonable Institute described as a boot camp for social entrepreneurs who come from around the world and essentially stay at sort of a frat house environment in Boulder while they meet mentors and investors. Can you just tell us a little more about the Unreasonable Institute and how it works?
Yeah, totally. So the first thing I'll do is put a big asterisk on frat house environment. what we're doing is we're bringing together about 25 entrepreneurs from typically about 20 countries, and we're putting them into one house under the same roof for 6 weeks, and our goal is to give them an unfair advantage in scaling up their solutions to solve these hard problems. So the reality of the environment is it's about as disciplined and as creatively charged as it could possibly be, because you've got all these misfit, obsessive entrepreneurs under the same roof who would die to see their company successful if they believe in them that much. But it is in a vacant fraternity or sorority house, Because in the summertime, we run these 6-week programs, and we need like a really large mansion to be able to house all these entrepreneurs, all these mentors, our chefs, all that type of stuff. So we use the fraternity sorority houses, whichever one's kind of the best one we can get our hands on, because they're empty in the summertime. So we get a really spectacular kind of deal on the rental of the place. So, you know, for us, what we're really trying to do here is, I think in some ways it's about accelerating serendipity. I think that, to be clear too, I don't run the Unreasonable Institute anymore. I'm operationally no longer on the team, and it's the founding team that's running the Institute and taking it to scale internationally. I'm running Unreasonable Group, which is, we're in the efforts of launching a venture fund and we have a media company and a couple other things where we realize that if we really want to help accelerate, kind of catalyze this next generation of entrepreneurs solving the hardest problems, we need to think of kind of multiple levels of support. But the Institute, I always make fun of myself and the whole team. Where, I really think like our, in some ways our job is to do nothing. What I mean by that, this is an oversimplification generalization, but I like to say that those who can't do teach and those who can't do or teach run institutes or accelerators, because basically we're conveners, right? Our job is to, select the world's most promising entrepreneurs and match them with those who've already done it, and the investors that will take the next level. But we're not the entrepreneurs, we're not the mentors, we're not the investors. We are, by design, trying to create the conditions in which they productively collide, right? Uncommon kind of collisions between ideas and people that can help take their companies to the next level. That's really what we're trying to do. That's why everybody lives in the same space, because it's our belief that these serendipitous connections, they happen on the fringes of structure, not within it. So, yes, we have workshops, and we're dialing in on their supply chain and their finance and their accounting and their term sheets and all of that, but it's the fringes of those where we're sharing lunch together or dinner, or you're in a white front of a whiteboard at 3 a.m. and you're brushing your teeth together. That's where the real collisions start to happen that take these companies kind of leaps forward with the relationships.
Right. So as you said, your connectors really, as you said, connecting the right people to the people they need to take their business and their crazy, wild, unbelievable ideas to the next level. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the word I would use isn't connecting, because it's really about the conditions.
Okay.
It's like relational alchemy.
Okay.
And I see connection as like, I just made up that word. But
relational I like relational alchemy. That's good. You're going to be coining a whole new phrase. I know that's going to be used elsewhere. I'm going to say we provide relational alchemy.
Sounds like a dating service. But
I love it. Well, it kind of is. It's speed dating. Entrepreneurs meet the mentors they need and the investors they need. It's a different kind of dating. Relational alchemy.
Totally right. Mm-hmm. Totally right. Well, the reason I hesitate with connectors is I see that more as when we write an email between two people, say, hey, you have to meet. For us, it's about creating conditions in which creativity flourishes. And we believe that relationships are a part of that.
Great. Perfect. Conditions where creativity flourishes. I love it. Okay, so at this point, how many unreasonable entrepreneurs have you helped to date, and from how many countries? Do you have any idea of the number?
I do have an idea, but I guarantee you it's not fully accurate.
Okay.
I haven't done the right tally, but it's about 85.
Okay.
And, operations, and I'm going to guess about 100 countries right now, operationally.
Wow. Right.
From, though, probably closer to 40 countries.
Okay.
So what I mean,
sorry.
A lot of the businesses are scaled across a number of countries, but they're based in one country.
Okay, they're scaled across many. Okay, I understand. So can you give us some of the examples of some unreasonable projects or businesses that you've helped create the conditions for so far? Like, what kind of things have come to you?
Yeah, well, so I actually So I'm like a real stickler with words. I don't know why, but I am. So actually, I will never use the word social entrepreneur. Or social enterprise, or even social innovation. And the reason I stray away from that is I feel like it's bifurcating. Because at the end of the day, what this is all about is how do you get the smartest people on earth to work on the hardest problems? I don't care what they call themselves. But that's really the push. And so for us, the people, the subset we choose to work with are entrepreneurs. So in terms of companies, I'll give you like kind of like maybe like a variant spectrum. So we just got off of running Unreasonable at Sea, which was a program on a ship that was experimenting in really transnational entrepreneurship. Like, how do you take what works in one region of the world and even begin to understand what it would look like in another? And you know, two of the companies on that ship, one of them, they're called Damascus Fortune. They are a nanotechnology company out of Singapore, a bunch of whip smart kind of recent graduates. They found a way to create a structure called carbon nanotubes. That is, it's 10 times stronger, 5 times lighter than steel, and has 300 times the connectivity of copper. So it's a material literally worth more than gold in its weight. They found a way to create carbon nanotubes out of carbon emissions. So they are profitably sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere, which has no precedent. And if we can really take that to market and scale it, it changes everything. Because the moment that you can profitably capture carbon emissions is the moment that it converts from a waste into a commodity. And that's the moment when the world will chase to capture it. So they're doing, it almost feels like magic, but it's real. So the, another company on the ship was iKnows. It's the largest offline search in the world. They have about 130 million active users, all using SMS. So the entrepreneur is named Deepak. He's going to university. He's 20 years old. He's in India. He looks around the subcontinent, and he realizes that 11% of the country has access to internet, 88% has access to dumb phones or phones with SMS. And he asks himself a simple question. He's like, why is it that the internet is, you know, free, prolific information in search, and yet SMS doesn't? Let's try to change that. And so more or less, he created the Google for SMS. So you can text his number. You can say driving directions, Mumbai to Chennai, and it will send you step-by-step driving directions, just like Google Maps would do. The amazing thing is that they can do it for free. So you can search any inquiry. You could say, where's the local health clinic, or how do I deal with contraceptions, or I have this cyst on my foot. You can actually take a photo of it. You can do photographic search, say, what is this? It will probably say, we don't know, but you should go to the local health clinic, which is located here. And so it's giving ubiquitous access to information for free to people with dumb phones. And the reason he can do that is because just like Google, he can then advertise, right? And so he has the largest targeted ad platform for dumb phones in India, and he knows what your search queries are and where your geolocation is. But he designed it in a way where now it's free access to the internet through dumb phones, which really is game-changing. And so he's one of the companies. But, on another end of the spectrum, you can look at more appropriate technologies. We have a company that is getting clean drinking water to 300,000 people every day in 5 countries, and they're doing so without any chemicals and without any energy input. It's just with plants. So developed a plant system that can treat water at municipal scale, so up to about 20,000 people, and can be locally harvested, locally operated, locally run, and it's a profitable model as well. So really interesting. He's going back in time and realized that 500 years ago, we had a different way of filtering and cleaning water. And this includes with heavy metals and acids and all of this it can clean. And so he's really adapted plant technology towards it. So those are 3 examples. So they're all different. Yeah.
Yeah, all amazing, as you said, and mind-boggling in some ways. Sorry, what was the name of the second one, the one using iKnows? SMS? Yeah. How do you spell that, Daniel?
I-N-N-O-Z.
Oh, I-N-N-O-Z. Okay, interesting. Just in case people want to look these up, that's incredible.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, unbelievable alchemy happening there. So, in the end, what role do you think entrepreneurs play in creating change in the world?
But I think the frontline innovators who are willing to risk everything to solve problems in real time, right? So the reason we believe desperately in entrepreneurs, and kind of obsessively, and I'll admit it's an assumption when we say something like entrepreneurship is, you know, the answer to nearly all the issues we face. You know, probably more accurate is entrepreneurial thinking is the answer. And the reason I say that is where most of the world sees issues, problems, and challenges. An entrepreneurial mindset sees opportunities and solutions and has a bias towards action, towards implementing those. And they're willing to risk everything towards solving those problems. Because, you know, I mean, entrepreneurs and businesses, they design products or services that solve problem sets. I think the difference for us at Unreasonable is we just choose the problem sets we want to solve, and we don't believe all problem sets were created equally, right? We want to work on the hardest ones. But it's that level of thinking and doing, which is you see a problem, you convert it into maybe it's an unfortunate opportunity, but it's an opportunity to be solved, and then you immediately lean into solving it.
Right, perfect. Thinking and doing, and not being afraid to fail, as you said, that sounds like a key component to, you know, why solutions are found. So, in addition to, as you said earlier, in not being afraid to fail, even if, you know, you only have 20% success rate, what else do you think have been some of the keys to the Unreasonable Institute's success in getting these people together and doing the work you're doing? What are
Yeah,
there
I
some
think it's I mean, the big thing is valuing people above everything. So, I mean, a core belief. This one's so obvious, I like hesitate to say it, but I mean, business is definitely business. There's no question. There are fundamentals, but more than anything, business is people, and it's all about relationships. So we pride ourselves in putting relationships above everything. And we're also a values-driven company. Every decision we make is based off of our value set, or at least we try to, right, as best as possible. And if we ever are in a situation where we like don't know the answer, we just go back to the values and we say, well, you know, how would we make it based off of these? And then it becomes pretty obvious. But I think that, you know, it's the same thing we look for in our entrepreneurs, which is a paradoxical blend of confidence and humility. So what I mean by that is enough confidence to believe that, hey, you know what, if this thing works, at least we have like a shot in hell at putting a positive dent on history. And enough humility to realize that thing is never going to work unless we are like pathologically collaborative with amazing people who are smarter than we are, right? And enough humility to also admit that however we go about it, it's probably wrong, but we'll persist in terms of persevering, trying to stumble into the right solution, right? But we don't believe we know any of the solutions. So I mean, I think that's a big part of it. So in terms of bringing people together, it was that blend, right? We'd sit down with a mentor, and it could be a co-founder of Facebook or whoever it is, but sit down with them and say, hey, you know, tell you what, like, this thing's a wild experiment. It may fail, but at the same time, I don't believe there's an experiment more noteworthy of at least my time right now in the world that I can think of. And the only thing that I know about this experiment is it will fail unless we have people like yourself involved, because we need mentors to really, you know, help gear up this next generation of entrepreneurs, and you'd be incredible. Like, would you like to join us? And pretty much everybody says, heck yeah. Because who doesn't want to be a part of at least, you know, experimentally, like experimenting wildly in effort to try to do things differently that could potentially really productively solve these big challenges we face. So I think it's that mix. It's like treating people really well, having enough humility to know that it's not about us, it's about them. But then having enough confidence to actually believe that this might really work, and we'll bet everything on it.
Right, like you said, taking the risk at all costs, and not just being willing, but I'm sure it's what really rocks an entrepreneur's world is to experiment wildly, like you said, to discover something you know, no one thought possible until, as you said, the conditions for creativity were there for it to happen. Amazing. How about yourself? Like, are there any practices or principles that you personally apply to achieve results?
Well, everything I've told you, like, in terms of, so all our values are very personal, right? It's very hard for me to distinguish a line between myself and unreasonable. And I think that's the case of, like, any, like, founder, if they really care about the brand. And so treating, you know, the whole company and myself have a value of, we try to treat everybody like the Messiah. What that means is the person in front of you is the most important person. Doesn't matter who's next to them. And just to be fully present. The belief of, striving to do what is perceived as the impossible with a 20% chance of success, that's a very personal thing as well. The hunger to choose problem sets that are worthy of our lives' work, that was a personal decision I made kind of freshman year in university. All of these are, they all cross over. I guess one of the biggest things is I don't believe that, I don't think the world is bifurcated. That's like a big personal belief. And I think that by and far, for some reason, it's perceived as such. Maybe it's just simpler to think about these two different worlds of things like nonprofit and for-profit. That just makes no sense to me. Because I think if we want to have the most amount of impact, at least in my mind, profit's the best driver for engineering and innovations and market for scale. And so let's use those towards solving the problems that the nonprofit community is so heavily geared towards, right? It's not an either or, it's combining the best of both. So it's really, I don't know if I'm making any sense right now.
Yeah, terrific. I think that's a perfect way to put it. It doesn't have to be either or, it's not bifurcated. It's collaboration. I mean, profit and nonprofit working together and, again, really both with the same goal, that they want to create change in the world. But you're right, to bring it to market and to scale it requires funds and resources. So, I think you said it perfectly. One really, they're working together as opposed to in opposition or in competition. I think that's a perfect way to describe that. And is there any advice that you would share with other people who want to make a difference in the world, whether it's through some wild experimentation of an idea or just some other vision they have? What advice or wisdom would you give them?
Yeah, so just be careful with words again. I wouldn't say advice or wisdom. I'd say perspective because I can't give myself that much credit. There's some perspective that I would have. I think the best form of criticism is creation. So that gets back to don't talk about it, just try to solve the problem. I think that everybody becomes shocked with how much ability they have once they dive into something and really give it their all. I would tell people, at least from my perspective, that you don't have to settle, and that you ought to seek, you know, convergence between what makes you come alive, what you can generate a living with, what you can be best in the world at. And when you seek convergence like that, you probably are going to feel like a misfit because most people are going to tell you it's impossible. I think they're wrong. I just think they haven't tried for whatever reason. So I would also just as much as possible just listen to your gut. Like, don't listen to the social constructions of what's appropriate. Because that doesn't, that's not the life at least I want to live. And just really, follow what you believe in and do it. And I know it sounds so cheesy, but it's that simple. It's just like taking that posture and like standing up a little bit differently and saying, I'm going to really do what I believe in and I'll find a way to make it work because the solution is not certain and it is not given to me. But we can lead lives where the solutions are handed to us. And that's okay for a lot of folks. But if you really want to kind of create your own path, then it just takes a different posture. But it's way more fun once you stand in it.
Absolutely. Create your own path. And, yeah. Well, that sort of leads me to the last question that I'm sure a lot of people want to know. The name The Unreasonable Institute, where does that come from? How did you come up with that?
Yeah, so just unreasonable at a high level, because we have unreasonable capital, unreasonable media, unreasonable FC, unreasonable adventures,
right.
Unreasonable institute, right? So obviously we're obsessed with that word. we borrowed it from a very good quote by the Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw. He said that the reasonable man adapts himself to the world, the unreasonable one persists in adapting the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable person. And, that sums up everything that we've talked about for the last 30 minutes. The converse of that, or the inverse, I don't know which one, but the opposite of that is, there's another quote, like Einstein, right? He said that the definition of insanity is really simple. It's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So to be unreasonable is to do something a little bit different and get different results. And I think that's what it really comes down to for us.
Right. Do something different and to get different results. Perfect. Perfect way to sum up exactly what you said and that we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes. So thanks so much, Daniel. Just one last thing. Where's the best mm-hmm. place for people to go to find out more about the Unreasonable Institute? So the website?
Yeah.
Is that the best?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the best spot is unreasonablegroup.com because that has
okay. Okay, because as you said, there's many unreasonable components to the Unreasonable Institute. Okay, great. So unreasonablegroup.com?
Yep.
Great. Okay, great. Well, again, thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
And, your inspiring perspective, even if you don't want to call it wisdom.
No,
your inspiring perspective.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, perspective's good. We can all use new perspective. And so can the world. And we can certainly use people willing to just go for it, no matter what anybody else thinks. As you said, they go with their gut and create their own path. And I think that really is going to lead to most solutions to most things.
Yeah.
So, again, thank you so much for your time. And, stay unreasonable and all the best.
Hey, thank you so much. It means a great deal to me. And I hope you have a good day.
You too. Thanks, Daniel. Take care.
Yes.
Bye-bye now.